think it's fine. Good. Yeah.
This text is structured around four images that demonstrate four different forms and practices of rendering lines. Each of these forms is in conversation with the railway and its image in different ways. The empire was in the business of drawing lines across maps in the sand. We live on, with, and through them. Among the enduring fault lines the British carved into the maps of the subcontinent are the borders of the new nation states of South Asia and the railway tracks, dead and living, that sprawl across them. Like most texts or drawings, these markings on sheets of paper, when read, speak more of the desires of those who rendered them than the geographies they claim to represent. They are mirrors, dream works, transferred from dream maps on and into the surface of the Indian earth. The smooth, hard iron lines of the railway tracks served as representational device. These vast networks were material and symbolic embodiments of colonial progress and its civilizing modernity. In a hostile landscape, the railways shrank distances and secured the outposts of empire, turning its restless, seething mass into a border stable territory. Control of the borderlands, the task of carving boundaries, was made possible by the trunk lines that traversed in and out of the frontier. These iron roads made the imagined borders of maps real. We are told they made India into a nation. The image of the nation performs its own erasure, enacting a range of violences and degradations on land and people in ways drawn out and diffuse. The railway project of mapping, inscribing, and controlling terrain, past and present, is enabled by imperial visualities, conjuring acts that represent landscape as empty, barren, unruly, banjar, ghair abad, or ghair mehfooz. Its textured spaces reduced to the rawness of nature, its inhabitants to glitches on the cartographer's surface. Imagining this blankness is essential to the railway and its earth writing on white paper. An imperial opacity whose power lies in the systematic narrowing and obscuring of local terrains and entangled histories. When the first railway tracks were laid in Sindh in 1858, some people recognized its hidden powers. They spoke of its impending wrath. John Brunton, a railway engineer, records an incident of natives sighting a locomotive engine. They did not dare go near it, he says, but from a distance cried out, "Shaitan, Shaitan." Others called it the great Rakshas, a demon known as the Destroyer, who brought death with its touch. Elders told tales of the Rakshas's prowess in sorcery. Its favorite branch of magic was, of course, illusion. Perhaps they spoke of the sorcery through which deserts and forests were recast as frontiers, empty, wild spaces waiting to be developed, dismembered, and packaged. A drama, a conjuring trick, an illusion that unleashed new, cruel ways of unseeing landscapes, of disengaging nature from local ecologies and livelihoods, of sanitizing the violence of an out-of-control capitalist extraction at the frontiers. They spoke of the death drive of development, of terror, destruction, and despair, unleashed by the proliferation of iron and wood that tightened its grip on the earth, a pathological force that paved death in its paths.
The image of the railways, in their cold, hard, imposing ubiquity, served for the British as representations of their superiority, their benevolence, their prowess over nature, and their drive for progress. Kipling wrote in The Voice of Krishna that the railways marked the beginning of the end. The fire carriages shout the names of new gods. The railways heralded a completion of the colonial project, yet the colonized turned an oppositional gaze towards these structures. They recognized the railway as a medium through which the colonizer spoke, through which the colonizer inscribed himself into and haunted our landscapes, made our spaces alien even to us. The railways invoked subservience. They were, in Gandhi's words, badges of slavery. For the anti-colonial struggle, railways became representations of the abject and the hateful. Gandhi understood the railway system as not that which connects, but divides, spreading alienation. Shrinking time and annihilating space, the railways could be a distributing agency for evil only, Gandhi wrote. Good travels at snail's pace. Experienced by Indians as sites of humiliation and brutality, the railways were ripe with the potential and inevitability of disruption and resistance. Throughout the nationalist movement, these sites were activated with protest, civil disobedience, and the circulation of political leaders as they spread the message of Quit India. The railways, the backbone of colonial power across the subcontinent, were appropriated for its resistance. The medium was turned against itself, and never more so than in the acts and practices of sabotage that intensified in the decades leading up to independence. Today, as the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, also known as CPEC, launches its own frontier-making project, a $62 billion adventure in infrastructure, we see a resurgence of colonial designs in Pakistan. The railways, now broken, neglected, degrading, encroached upon by surrounding communities and ecology, are once again subject to a colonial gaze, with grand plans to restore and upgrade this abandoned infrastructure. In these emergent and degraded ecologies, the same set of issues and questions are presenting themselves to us as phantoms of colonial violence, an upgraded imperial order of resource extraction sustained through similar technologies of visuality, infrastructure, and expansion. They tell us of the pleasures of progress, of resource booms, conjuring a world more dreamlike and sweeter than anything that exists. Yet, as we confront and travel through these expansive, mutating imperial formations, we remember the Rakshas, its illusory visions. We remember Sight's larger destructive force. We delve through the sediment of toxic corrosions and violent accruals of colonial aftermaths that layer the ground, abrasions left over from imperial practice of looking as targeting, its afterlives still unfolding as new wounds surface around us. Lives and histories entangled with the railway tracks, we witness the drying and hardening of soil, the railway sleepers restless against this hardened ground. The iron buckles, warps and breaks, a rupturing of straight lines and fixed parts. As the creosote wears off these tracks, smooth surfaces give way to rot, a material and psychic eating away of bodies, environments, and possibilities. The rot of colonialism too remains with us, the Rakshas, long after the colonizers have returned home, and it is alive, if sleeping, awaiting the possibility of return. The Rakshas is a sensory regime embodied, gouged deep in the material landscape, an inextricable interweave that ensnares, knots, and gnarls.
Beginning with the construction of the first two railway lines in 1850s India, that connected port cities of Calcutta and Bombay to coal mines and cotton fields, the forest frontiers of the subcontinent were mined in vast quantities. Species diversities that had developed over millions of years were cleared, burned, sacrificed, creating uninhabitable landscapes. In the northwest Himalaya, instead of biodiversity, colonial botanists, loggers and officers saw only one family of trees, the Cedrus deodara. Its sole value, the great durability of its timber for railway sleepers. Deodars are remarkable giants emerging out of the lower canopy to tower over forests, growing among many other families and species of oaks and coniferous trees with a mixture of maples, elms, hornbeam, birch, and poplars. Yet, the colonizer imagined the forest as a pure stand. Deodar in Sanskrit means godwood. God Agni, the fire, on becoming the priest of gods, shook off his body. His bones became the deodar tree. A hidden fire burnt within and sustained the mighty evergreen trees in the forest where the linga of the Lord fell. The sacred tree became a favorite place of the sages. Yet in the mid-19th century, the Cedrus deodara was reimagined as disposable wood for the growing railway industry. The rest of the tree, herbs, fungi, and fauna, became waste products. The Rakshas wreaked havoc in the forests, imposing its new imperial order. Through the Indian Forest Act of 1878, in a process that mirrored the acquisition of land for railway construction, forests became state property. Local rights were written out of existence, emptying the landscape conceptually of its human residence. It asked participants to see a landscape that didn't exist, at least not yet. It continually erased indigenous rights to create frontiers of wild and empty spaces where discovering resources, not stealing them, was made possible.
The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor continues these conjuring tricks. Its infrastructural networks continue to expand landscape emptiness, sanitizing the violent extraction of new lands, minerals, and raw materials. They also expand imaginings of danger and wildness. Quiet scenes of forests, fields, and houses give way to wild terrains of danger and insecurity. Development and security intertwine as fear and threat are embedded in and are byproducts of the process of securing new frontiers. Frontiers make wildness, entangling visions and vines and violence, stretching backward as well as forward in time. The imagined wildness requires a hostile mode of sight from those who seek to control it, turning everything in sight into a threatscape, unruly subjects on unruly landscapes. The colonizers' hunting eyes early on sensed a potential threat in the terrain to turn insurgent against itself. The threat of sabotage from native dissidents was ever present in the unruly landscapes. In the face of this opacity, the new systems of order put in place by those who made maps, those who drew borders, started to glitch. Colonizers responded by militarizing terrain. Railway engineers were drilled twice a day as soldiers, a regular railway police force was deployed, and police stations were erected along the railways. Forest frontiers witnessed a simultaneous militarization. As indigenous people became outlaws in their own land, forest rangers were appointed to maintain order and discipline. They had the power to seize property, the power to arrest without warrant, to impound cattle trespassing, and to take possession of produce. The power to discipline the forest in the image of empire. In the spirit of securing new unruly landscapes today, the paramilitary Pakistan Rangers have taken on unprecedented powers. Although its patrol extends well beyond the forest, through cities and borders, its logo remains a tree. The mirage of CPEC is made possible through national discipline and the violence of the military. It is a conjuring that supports the most terrible of national imperial dreams, bringing old colonial forms to life in the contemporary landscape.
The proposed restorations and constructions of CPEC, the circulatory networks of its fantasies, traverse against some of the most fraught landscapes and touch upon some of the most sensitive raw nerves of the Pakistani national project. The borders and boundaries, the lines through which the British mapped Pakistan, have all been heavily contested, especially in the province of Balochistan. Since the Pakistan military marched on Balochistan in April 1948 and forcibly acquired the province, the Baloch have waged 5 insurgencies against Pakistan. As the new Pakistani state appropriated its former colonizers' visions and practices, so too the Baloch nationalist struggle turned the same tactics and vocabularies of resistance deployed against British, now against its new occupier. In the present era of Chinese-funded massive infrastructural growth and its accompanying land resource acquisitions, securitization, and militarization, there are new stakes to these old struggles. The Rakshas reemerges, plotting destruction in its path. The Pakistani military has systematically traced the path of the proposed and former railways across the provinces of Sindh and Balochistan, raiding and destroying villages along the way, disappearing Baloch and Sindhi men by the hundreds, their mangled corpses emerging weeks later in the landscape. Evan Calder-Williams writes of how the history of sabotage is linked with the railway system through the sabot, a stopper that holds the rails in place and slows trains on a downhill. The event that first brought the word sabotage into wide usage was the French railway strike of 1910, where the sabots were destroyed by railway workers in an act of sabotage. Though Gandhi had considered the railways emblematic of colonial evil, he did not condone sabotage. Civil disobedience and protest at railway sites was largely acceptable within the nationalist movement, but sabotage was considered unruly, outside the realm of politics altogether, and often cast as the work of drunks and criminals. In the Satyagraha, sabotage was considered tragic, representing an extreme lawlessness practiced by rogues, not citizens, an incoherence and opacity to the action that could only be understood as the work of someone outside of their senses, a political action without an ends. Yet, sabotage was practiced widely, culminating in what official reports described as an orgy of destruction of communications.
Despite its representations as unruly and irrational, sabotage during the anti-colonial movement was often practical and calculated, strategically planned to paralyze communications and transport in specific locations, to isolate targets, attack specific trade and industries. Distances became the strongest weapon of the revolution, restoring the subcontinent to a former opacity against the colonial desire for accessibility for which the railway had been a key instrument. Sabotage worked against the railway as instrument and as image. The spectacle of sabotage exploited the symbolic nature of the railways, working on a representational level through the desecration of the single most emblematic image of British rule. Intervening upon, bringing disorder to its smooth, solid lines, disabling the railway tracks of their colonial functions, returning, reducing them to their material selves, refamiliarizing the landscapes, resistance in the realm of images. Today, the railways and its concomitant landscapes, as key sites for the flows of capital and images representative of colonial visions of modernity, a modernity marked by resource extraction, environmental destruction, death, and disappearance, continue to be key sites of resistance. Sabotage continues to be an easily demonized yet much utilized method of resistance against the material structures of the railways. In Sindh, the outlawed separatist Sindhu Desh Liberation Army almost solely focused their actions on damaging railway infrastructure, with 23 different incidents of low-intensity blasts on railway tracks in 2011 alone. In Balochistan, the similarly outlawed separatist Baloch Liberation Army routinely uploads video footage on YouTube channels of similar actions, culminating in visuals of mangled iron and halted trains against quiet, desolate landscapes. Discourse around railway sabotage reveals the racist underpinnings of and anxieties around colonial and capitalist concepts of progress and development. In response to sabotage, the Pakistani military state falls comfortably back into racist colonial tropes of Sindhis and Baloch as particularly regressive, rebellious, and unproductive citizens. Who wouldn't want development? Savages, of course. But the saboteur does not shrink away from abjection. The saboteur is a bad subject, the worst kind, as they ignore all the set rules of warfare, resistance, and representational politics. They work instead with spectacle, shattering the image of development of a progressive Pakistani state. Sabotage works with the Fanonian dictate that colonial speciality must be thrown into complete disorder, must be undone. The saboteur, working in intimacy with the materiality of colonial rule, can turn the system, its materials, against itself. All colonial and capitalist logics, the necessity of development, progress, cooperation, are discarded. Sabotage is a complete refusal. It negates capitalist values of life as work and productivity, turning the death drive of development against itself in spectacular moments of collapse.
What does a border look like when it comes undone? A ruptured border or a rotting border? A border turned against itself? A border that can no longer hold, that buckles under the pressure of all the contestations upon it? The spirit of sabotage is not only reflected in these more spectacular actions, but also unfolds in more durational ways. There are many ways to obstruct the smooth flows of railways. There are many ways in which its surrounding landscapes get activated against it. Weeds may envelop the iron grids, and trees may spread roots in their midst. Homes, barbershops expand, encroach upon, and transgress its boundaries. As communities and ecologies go about the business of living in imperial ruins, they desecrate and overcome the imperial project, its images and icons.
The image of the railway has transformed. While we are still offered the fantasy of it, its existential reality looks more like the severed, mangled railway track, rotting iron encroached upon. These images haunt the colonizer's image of modernity, and they tell the story of its inevitable collapse. The medium speaks against the image, against the colonial narrative of the necessity for progress. It tells us the story of the inevitability of resistance and refusal, of fracture and the radical ongoingness of life in its wake. They inscribe into the materials of these structures the truth of their violence and the death they paved into our landscapes. They do the work of re-rendering the lines and reframing the grids we live on and in.
Thank you.